Welcome, everybody. This is the office hours session for, I believe, week 6 of Econ 2, the second course or class in Murray Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State. And I will turn it over to you guys. We got a few people logged in, so start firing away. Okay, Benjamin says, one person whose forecasts have been as consistently wrong about gold is Nouriel Roubini. Lately, he has been on a smoking hot crusade against gold in his Twitter feed. He claims, quote, under gold, serial episodes of large inflation and deflation caused by random discoveries of gold changing supply, highly destructive boom bust, end quote. And another quote, random gold supply shock can't be controlled. Fiat is policy, end quote. Would you comment on this? What kind of fantasy explanation do these anti-gold people have about the origin of money? Sure. So Benjamin's right. I mean, I've been noticing it. I read Economic Policy Journal, which is Robert Wenzel's blog. And Wenzel, for those of you who don't know, is a financial blogger, but he's very well steeped in Austrian economics and comments on the news of the day, financial news of the day from that perspective. And he's been reproducing Nouriel Roubini's tweets on this stuff, and I left a comment on one of the posts saying, you know, I wouldn't have thought this was a world-renowned economist. For those who don't know, Roubini is very respected around the world, and he's a Keynesian, but he was one of the ones early on who predicted that there was going to be a serious banking crisis, and people called him Dr. Doom, and they actually... I don't know if they laughed at him, but as early as 2005, maybe. I might be off in terms of the timing, but well before it was accepted that we were in trouble, Roubini was at academic conferences giving some pretty uncanny predictions about what was coming. I mean, he was calling things about as well as Peter Schiff was. You know how nowadays you look back at Peter Schiff saying stuff on TV in 2006, and it's amazing how accurate his descriptions were. Well, actually, Nouriel Roubini, coming from a completely different ideological perspective, was similarly accurate in his warnings about what was going to happen. So anyway, it's just astounding that a guy with that much, you know, credibility or celebrity or whatever you want to call it, is making these sophomoric sounding tweets ripping on gold, because like I say, it's not that he's making real reasoned, scholarly, well, in my estimation, going back to a gold standard would, you know, put deflationary pressures in our system. Well, but he's not talking like that, like Benjamin's saying. They're just real like pot shots, like he's in a slug match with somebody. So anyway, I think part of what's going on here, just like this, you can see like the other side is massing its forces against Ron Paul. I think the Keynesian establishment, or whatever term you want to use, they can see that they're losing control, both in terms of just things are getting out of hand in terms of policy control. Like I think Ben Bernanke and Geithner, Treasury Secretary Geithner, they are realizing that this is slipping away from them and that they don't have the power to steer the economy the way they thought a few years ago. And, I mean, just the Treasury getting downgraded, people openly talking about the dollar not being the world's reserve currency in a few years. I mean, not that it's going to happen and not that people are in positions of power are necessarily saying that, but just that now that's even on the table. And to bring it back to gold, I mean, I was astounded just the other day on Morning Joe on MSNBC. You had people there talking about Ron Paul, talking about how he was influenced by Friedrich Hayek and Ludwig von Mises, because they didn't know how to pronounce Mises' name, and talking about, the, you know, then they were joking, saying, so what do you think? Should we go back on gold? Ha, ha, ha. You know, and the person's like, no, I'm not saying that. I'm just saying that it is. But, I mean, 5 years ago, they wouldn't be talking about Hayek and Mises, and they wouldn't be joking saying, should we go back on gold? So the point is the public, there's a growing segment of people who are totally for Ron Paul, who are totally against the Fed. I mean, just the fact that Rick Perry felt it would be wise for him strategically to say Bernanke is a traitor and all that kind of stuff. I mean, this is different. This is unusual. Ron Paul really brought the Fed to the table in terms of discussions in his first campaign, or, you know, his 08 campaign. And, you know, I'm embarrassed to say, back when he was doing that in the 08 campaign, I thought it was a mistake. I thought that, no, you know, you're probably not going to win, so just try to get yourself ingratiated with a strong demographic just to, you know, for educational purposes and just to have a good showing so that next time it's more respectable for people to look at the true free market candidate. And I thought the way he would be the cool candidate that would resonate with young people especially would be to talk about ending the drug war and bringing the troops home. But no, he's going around talking about monetary policy, and he's getting college kids to start chanting end the Fed when he would show up to give a talk. So, I mean, it was just amazing. It just showed, which in retrospect isn't surprising, that he was Ron Paul's a better politician than I am, that he can read the electric and he knew the best way to put himself on the map, as it were. So in my long roundabout way of just setting the context, I think that's why Rubini is just visceral with his hatred of gold. I mean, like I say, this isn't just something about, oh, well, you know, there's various policy options, and I think the Fed should target a broader commodity basket as opposed to a narrow single commodity like the price of gold. But that's not the way he's talking. He's like a teenager who's had his girlfriend stolen by a rival, and he's lashing out or something. So it's, I think that's the emotional component of it, is that these elites, Muriel Rubini is definitely an elite. You know, he's plugged in with all the policymakers. He goes to these secret, well, they're not secret because I know about them too, but these meetings where it's hard to get into, where it's just like the really important people, you know, Nuriel Rubini is one of the guys that goes to those things, right? So he's definitely plugged in and connected and hobnobs with the rich and powerful. And so I think those types of people get very alarmed when they see somebody like Ron Paul gaining such traction. And then they try to ignore him, and then Jon Stewart goes and does that thing on The Daily Show, and now it's a big story about how the media is ignoring Ron Paul, so now we can't ignore him. I mean, they don't like that stuff. They liked it back in the day when the Fed was very boring and no one even talked about it. They don't like people debating whether there should be a Federal Reserve. So I think that's partly what's going on here, and so they just have to make sure they whip their troops into shape and lay down the law and set the agenda that everyone knows the gold standard is so incredibly stupid that we don't even need to think about it. Like, don't even bother wasting your time. Trust us. The gold standard was awful. So now when you ask, okay, but is there any merit in what he was saying? I mean, I'm not an expert on U.S. economic history. You know, Tom Woods would know that stuff better than I would. It's not that I've gone through and cataloged the causes and consequences of every single financial panic in U.S. history, but for sure I can say the two worst crises happened after the Fed was founded, you know, the Great Depression and what we're going through right now. And clearly what we're going through right now isn't the fault of the gold standard, and then even the Great Depression, there as an Austrian, I would argue, no, the stock market bubble in the late 20s was clearly not the fault of the gold standard. What was going on there, it's, if anything, was the opposite. It was, that was what happened because Great Britain was trying to cheat on the gold standard. That they went off gold during World War I, they printed up a bunch of pounds, and then they tried to go back to the gold standard at the pre-war parity, which was unrealistic at that point. So they were trying to, you know, they didn't want to acknowledge, for matters of prestige and so forth, because, you know, London was the financial center of the world and Great Britain was the big empire and the foundation of Western civilization in their mind. And so it would have been embarrassing for them to admit that they had been profligate during World War I and they had to go tie the pound back to gold at a depreciated rate. So Great Britain was in trouble all through the 20s. You know, they would have had to have gone through severe deflation in order to get things back in equilibrium. The labor unions didn't want to do that, so there was widespread unemployment. And then you had gold being shipped from Great Britain to the United States. So that is one of the main reasons the U.S. consciously inflated in the mid-20s, that they met with, you know, the head of the New York Fed, Strong, met with the head of the Bank of England, and they quite consciously said, okay, the Bank of England is in trouble. The, you know, the pound is overvalued relative to the dollar in terms of the official parity you guys are trying to do. Speculators know that. That's why they're turning in their pounds for gold from you guys and then depositing it with us in the United States, because they know that you overvalued the pound. So they said, well, there's two things we could do. One is, you guys, we could wait for your guys' wages and prices in Great Britain to go down so that now the pound isn't overvalued relative to the dollar, gold. But that's going to be very painful. Or what we can do is we can inflate the dollar, and so that will take pressure off of it. So it's, you know, so that we'll inflate so that your prior inflation isn't as bad relative to us anymore. And so that's what they chose to do. And then that's what fueled, if you're an Austrian, that's what you think fueled the U.S. stock bubble in the late 20s. And so that's partly why we had the Great Depression. And then even beyond that, people say, oh, well, look at, you know, when countries left the gold standard during the 1930s, they began their recovery much more quickly. And there's like a famous diagram that Barry Eichengreen, I think, and some other economic historians have constructed, and guys like Brad DeLong and Paul Krugman love it, because it shows if you arrange countries in terms of, if you have an index of their, I think it's industrial output is the metric they use, from like 1929 through 1941, and then you arrange them and you can show, you know, which countries you can, you know, in the beginning, obviously, from 29, 30, 31, every country's lines are going down because everybody's industrial production was sinking like a stone. But then some countries start turning around much earlier than other ones. And you can, and so then you sort the countries by when did they turn around and their, you know, their industrial output stopped falling and started rising. And it's not a perfect match, but there's a rough match where the countries that left gold first are the ones that saw a turnaround first, whereas the countries that stubbornly held on, like the United States, and I think France was the latest one, it looks like their industrial production was the most sluggish compared to their peers. And so guys like Krugman and DeLong point at that and say, see, if only the policymakers back then had been smart enough, wise enough, brave enough to ditch the gold standard earlier, they would have gotten out of the Depression sooner. But, you know, I point out, that's crazy. The U.S. left the gold standard in early 1933, right, when FDR came in and closed it. And then you could say he went back on gold the next year if you want to, but it was certainly not the classical gold standard at that point. And for purposes of that chart showing when countries left gold and the recovery started, I mean, that's, they're saying, okay, you left gold. So did the U.S., was it really, oh, the U.S. was in full recovery in 1933, and then, you know, it did really well the next year? No. I mean, the U.S., even pointing at the inner period before the 37-38 downturn, the U.S. still had unemployment that was, I think, higher than 14% for that whole period. So this is kind of a broader point that I make. When you ask a Keynesian, point me to some historical episode where your policies actually work. Not where you have to do a counterfactual and say, if we hadn't done this, there would have been utter catastrophe, but since we did our policies, there was only mild catastrophe, because that's like the way it is right now with the Obama stimulus package. Right? The Keynesians say, well, it's a good thing we did that. We should have just done more, and the economy is awful right now. And you say, well, what do you mean it's a good thing you did that? You guys put your policy into place, and the economy got worse. And they say, oh, well, yeah, but the economy would have been even worse had we done nothing. And so that's what, when they go and look at the historical data, that's the way their explanations always run. So when you ask a Keynesian, okay, give me an example of where your policies work, for a lot of them, candidate number one is World War II, and candidate number two is the 1930s, And they'll say, yeah, the countries that went off gold and started spending money like crazy were the ones that saw rebounds in their economy. And so they're pointing at the 1930s and the economies in that decade is evidence of how good their policies are for fostering prosperity. As if there was any economy in any year in the 1930s that could be said to have been healthy. Like even, you know, they will point at FDR and say, oh yeah, from 33 to 37, he was really doing a good job. When unemployment was higher than 14%, I think that's the number, for the whole period. And they're saying, oh, well, it was really high, it was coming down. Okay, but in every other financial downturn in the history of the world, things get really bad, and then they get better. So the fact that things started to get better eventually doesn't prove that FDR did a good thing. You would have to show they got better more quickly than they would in a typical recovery. And that certainly wasn't the case, that 4 years after FDR's allegedly magical policies were put into place, you still had double-digit unemployment. So anyway, those are my general thoughts about talking about the gold standard, that it's kind of funny to say, oh yeah, you have these wild ups and, you know, booms and busts under the gold standard, when, no, we had the worst booms and busts after the founding of the Fed and after these scientific managers came in and were supposed to spare us from the alleged horrors of a laissez-faire macroeconomy. Also, another point, Benjamin, you had said, what fantasies do they have about the origin of money? It's funny you say that. This isn't necessarily applicable to Rubini, but the people that call themselves MMT, modern monetary theorists, they think that money comes from the state, that they think to explain the origin of money, there has to be a government that was taxing people, and that's how you explain it. Now, I'm not sure if they're saying actually in human history that explains the formation of every kind of money, because this, on the face of it, that seems like a strong claim to make, because surely there's some, you know, primitive tribes somewhere that use money and yet don't really have a government the way we mean the term and don't have taxation. But I don't know what their claim is, if they're making a strong claim, but for sure they think Mises is wrong with his regression theorem. They think that it's a very plausible hypothesis to say that the state created money because people needed it to pay taxes, and that's what singled out one commodity as being special and that everyone needed to acquire it, and so that's how it became a common medium of exchange. But I don't know what Rubini thinks about it. It's possible, I think a lot of economists who haven't dwelt much on this topic, I think probably a lot of them believe that, or they would have no problem saying, sure, money originally emerged out of the market spontaneously in the way that Mises and Menger said, but that why wouldn't we improve that now with our modern techniques of central banking and so forth, now that we're armed with modern macroeconomic knowledge? Just like, you know, you could say certain ways of dealing with childbirth emerged naturally over the centuries. But nowadays, when someone's going into labor, we rush into a hospital and give birth in a hospital, even though that's not the way they did it 1,000 years ago. So, you know, somebody could say that and agree, yeah, historically childbirth was done in the home with just a midwife there to help you, but nowadays we're more advanced than that. So somebody might have that view and say, sure, gold and silver and other commodities used to be money hundreds of years ago, but we've moved beyond such childishness now, and we see the flaws of why the gold standard didn't work, so now we're doing something much more scientific. Okay, Anthony Zeger says, other than Robert Wenzel, what other blogs do you read? In a previous office hours, you mentioned that you read about 7 blogs regularly. Well, if you go to my website, which is consultingbyrpm.com/blog, the things on, I think it's the left column where I have the blog role, those are the ones I typically read. The reason I set that up is because when I'm reading it on my BlackBerry, to go to the sites I like, it's real easy just to go to my own site and then just click those links. So basically, the stuff that I read when I'm in an airport or something using my BlackBerry is the stuff that's linked from my blog's main page. Okay, Benjamin says, if Krugman were dictating policy for an economic recovery, what would he do? It seems to me that he wants trillions of dollars in stimulus. How would he do this? How would he get around blowing up the dollar and the debt ceiling, not to mention $400 oil, etc.? What are the odds that Bernanke, as a last-ditch effort, will try and pull a Krugman? Okay, well, let's be careful. There's different things going on here. Strictly speaking, by itself, a fiscal deficit, meaning that the federal government borrows a bunch of money and spends it, that by itself is not inflationary. What that might do is drive up interest rates as the government tries to borrow more. You know, in a standard analysis, that's what would happen. But in a standard analysis, when the government and even like somebody like Murray Rothbard would agree, by itself, the government borrowing a bunch of money and spending it drives up interest rates. It doesn't necessarily drive up prices in general, because that action of the government running a deficit per se is not inflationary. That doesn't create more money. It just, the government borrows money from people in the private sector and spends it, so it changes which prices go up, but it's not going to cause prices in general to go up, at least not directly. So Krugman, when he says he wishes the Obama stimulus had been bigger, he's talking there about fiscal policy. So if you wanted to say, suppose that had gone through, what would have happened? That per se would not have wrecked the dollar necessarily. That just would have, in my opinion, caused unemployment to be even higher, because it would have further misallocated resources, and it would have just made us poorer, but it wouldn't have necessarily wrecked the dollar. Now, probably what I think you have in mind is, in practice, massive government budget deficits do tend to go hand in hand with inflation, because the central bank assists the process. It makes the deficits less painful because the central bank tends to monetize some of the debt. And that's certainly what's been happening in the last few years. That side by side, as the Treasury runs trillion-dollar plus deficits year after year, you've got Ben Bernanke entering the market and buying trillions of, well, at least more than $1 trillion worth of government bonds and adding them to the Fed's balance sheet. So that, of course, is inflationary. So I'm not saying, Benjamin, that you weren't aware of that distinction. I just want to make the distinction and make sure everybody who hears this is aware of it. So again, just to summarize, in standard Austrian theory, as well as I think like what a Chicago school person would say, strictly speaking, when the Treasury borrows money and spends it, that does not debase the dollar. Just like if a corporation borrows money, that you wouldn't say that, oh, that's going to wreck the dollar. Or even, your household, if you borrow money, you're not raising prices and weakening the purchasing power of the dollar. You're just, if you borrow money and go spend it, there's somebody else who lent it to you, so they're spending less than they could have. So it's just transferring who spends the money. And it's the same thing, the same principle, even if it's the U.S. Treasury doing the spending. But what I'm saying is, what is true is that the Fed will try to protect the Treasury from its profligacy. So yeah, if the Treasury would normally enter the credit markets, borrow $1.6 trillion, and that would push up interest rates, the Fed is waiting in the wings to say, oh, no, we're not going to let interest rates go up, because we're just going to print up money and buy those treasuries from the secondhand market and push those interest rates back down. And we're going to make an announcement to the markets. We're going to keep interest rates down near zero for the next 2.5 years. And so that sets its expectations, and so everyone just believes that the yield on treasuries is going to be really low. So the two certainly in practice go hand in hand, but you just got to be careful about what causes what. So you're asking now, if what would if you're asking me, pretend I'm Paul Krugman, and how do I answer you, I would say, you're crazy, Benjamin. Why would you think that would cause prices to rise? If we look at certain metrics of what the market expects, you know, look at the bond market, look at long-term, you know, 10-year yields on U.S. treasuries, on conventional nominal treasuries, and then look at the 10-year yield on what's called the TIPS market. So TIPS is Treasury Inflation Protected Securities. So that's a bond that the U.S. Treasury issues where they adjust the principal based on CPI inflation. So the idea is what you're getting when you buy TIPS is a guaranteed real rate of return, because they adjust. So if prices go up 3%, they take your principal and bump it up 3%, so that you're earning the contractual interest rate, but it's on a principal that's adjusted with prices in general, so that it keeps you whole. And so obviously the rate of return on a TIPS bond is lower than on a conventional one, because the TIPS bond has that capacity of having the principal get bumped up, whereas a regular bond doesn't. So you'd be willing to lend money buying a TIPS at a lower stated interest rate or yield, because that's a real yield, whereas the conventional treasury bond is only a nominal yield. So then what you do is you subtract the two, and you say, oh, that's a good ballpark estimate of what the market, the bond market, thinks price inflation is going to be over the next 10 years on average. So that if I'm making these numbers up, I haven't looked them up recently, but if investors are lending money to the government for 10 years at an annual rate of 3%, and they're willing to accept the TIPS real yield of only 1%, then that means the market, or the bond market more specifically, is only forecasting a 2% annualized rate of price inflation over that 10 years. So that's the basic idea. There's obviously more nuances and complications if you really wanted to get technical. But if you do look at things like that, it does seem like the bond market is not worried about price inflation. And that's, I have to say, in terms of me trying to argue with other academics, that is the one stumbling block that I have. Because obviously you can look at the price of gold, you can look at commodities, you can look at producer prices, you can look at all sorts of things that make it look like, holy cow, inflation is coming hard, batten down the hatches. But yet, when it comes to investors and bond yields, it looks like they're not worried about price inflation. So that's kind of odd. So that's what Krugman would say. It's not that he thinks there's going to be $400 oil and he can live with that. He thinks you're wrong for being worried about that. And he, to be honest, I've never seen Krugman spell out how the Fed gets out of its current situation, because it's clear if things went back to normal. So let's say the government did what Krugman thought it should do and borrowed $2 trillion more and spent it on, you know, fixing roads and bridges and stuff like that, or increased food stamps or something, job training programs. And so we got real GDP close to potential GDP, and then the economy became self-sustaining recovery. Well, at that point, the Fed would start, or the commercial banks would start lending out those excess reserves. And so the Fed would have to do something. And I guess, like I said, I've never seen Krugman really spell this part of his plan out, or his worldview out. I'm assuming he thinks things would just naturally unwind. So as other interest, you know, so as unemployment started falling, and then you started seeing these conventional indices of expected future inflation start rising, then, as in textbook fashion, the Fed would have to start easing off. So the Fed, they would start raising interest rates, and they would, and how do they do that? They start sucking reserves out of the system by selling assets off their balance sheet. And so I'm guessing Krugman would just say that would just be a natural process where the Fed starts raising interest rates and lets its balance sheet shrink, And because there's a healthy recovery in place, that contractionary action by the Fed doesn't blow up any of the banks. That they take it in stride because we've got a healthy recovery going. I guess that's what he would say. And so you'd never see $400 oil. You just see things would gradually go back to normal. And that, you know, you guys are crazy. Because Krugman thinks you can't get significant price inflation as long as there's high unemployment. All right, so he endorses the old school Phillips curve that says there's a trade-off between price inflation and unemployment, and he thinks when there's a lot of slack in the economy, you can't get what he would call a wage price spiral. So I'm stunned that this thing has come back because I thought the 1970s killed that idea. You know, this is the old school Keynesian view that policymakers can fight one evil or the other, that there can either be high unemployment or high price inflation, but you would never have to deal with both at the same time, because in the Keynesian view, you know, recessions and inflation are about aggregate demand. If aggregate demand is too low, then you've got unemployment, but hey, at least you don't have rising prices. On the other hand, if prices are rising too fast, it's because the economy's overheating, there's too much demand, but hey, at least you're going to be at full employment because there's so much demand. And so I and a lot of other free market economists thought the 1970s had driven a stake through the heart of that view. Because during the 70s, quite famously, we had stagflation of high unemployment and high price inflation simultaneously. So if you're an old school Keynesian, what does that mean? The aggregate demand is too high and too low at the same time? What's the Fed supposed to do? But like I say, that view has now returned. And you've got Krugman and a lot of other people saying, you know, these guys like Peter Schiff who are worried about the dollar collapsing, they're nuts. You can't have rising price inflation without rising wages, and you can't have rising wages when there's 10% unemployment. And so they think that the only way price inflation would ever become a serious problem is if we were already in recovery and unemployment, you know, was back down to 4% or something. So that's what his view is, and he doesn't think, Benjamin, that the Fed could ever find itself in between a rock and a hard place where the economy's still awful, unemployment's 11%, and prices are rising 15% a year. He doesn't think that's possible, or at least he doesn't see the U.S. ever getting to that situation. See, that's the thing that's funny is it's not just the U.S. in the 70s, Zimbabwe too. Zimbabwe, when its currency was falling apart and it was having like 1,000,000,000% inflation rates, its unemployment rate was above 80% in that period too. So it's not like the central bank in Zimbabwe was printing up tons of Zimbabwean dollars, but at least everybody had a job. That wasn't the case at all. No, the economy, the real economy, was falling apart too. So it's, you know, I'm not saying the U.S. is going to turn into Zimbabwe. What I am saying, though, is Krugman's confidence that we can't have stagflation just, you know, anyway, preaching to the choir here, but that's how I would answer your question. And then you say the last thing you asked was, what are the odds that Bernanke is a last-ditch effort, will try and pull a Krugman? Well, this is actually an interesting point. Let me clarify Krugman's views here. So, Krugman's point, I'm trying to think of the best way to say this. Krugman thinks that the Fed does have options. Let me back up. Sorry, guys. I'm just trying to think of how much to explain because I'm getting my classes mixed up. I forget that you guys aren't the Keynesian class, even though I think some of you were in that class too. All right. Krugman's standard view, and this is a standard Keynesian view, or new Keynesian view, I should say, is that normally when there's a recession, that's because the aggregate demand is too low, right? There's not enough total spending, and that can be investment spending or consumer spending, right? So it doesn't have to just be consumer spending. But businesses and consumers collectively are not spending enough to buy enough products and services from businesses so that when they optimize and figure out how many people do we need to hire to satisfy the demand, that they're hiring everyone who wants to work. And so that's why there's slack in the system, there's unemployed resources, there's idle workers, and the economy is producing below what's called the potential output. So the solution to that, according to Keynesians, is you got to change something to get there to be more spending. And so they say normally what you do is you don't need Congress to do anything because that takes too long, and they argue about how much to spend. So, yeah, if you had a dictator, he could just spend more. The government could just spend more, but we're in a democracy, and it takes too long. By the time they agreed on a stimulus package, the recession might be over. So in normal times with a standard garden variety recession, Krugman and other Keynesians say what you have is the Fed just lowers interest rates. And then the lower interest rates stimulates consumers to spend more, and it stimulates businesses to invest more. And so that's how you get total spending back up to where it needs to be to provide full employment. You just lower interest rates. That's it. You don't need fiscal policy. You don't need the government to run a budget deficit. So the only problem, though, is what happens if the economy is in such bad shape, or that for some reason expected price inflation is so low that it turns out the market clearing interest rate at which you would have full employment is negative. And so that what you would be telling the Fed is, oh yeah, just keep pushing down interest rates. The Fed pushes interest rates down to zero and we still have unemployment. You know, there's still slack in the economy. So normally you would just say, oh, we'll push interest rates down some more, but they can't. You can't push interest rates down below zero. For, you know, just for obvious reasons, if someone's going to lend $100 to somebody, he's not going to say, oh, here's $100, give me back $95 next year, which is what a negative interest rate would be. Why would anyone do that? They would just sit on their cash. Okay, so the Fed cannot push interest rates, nominal rates, below zero. So that's why Krugman's always talking about being pressed up against the zero lower bound. That's the big bugaboo about that, is because normally they say the way to stimulate spending is to push down interest rates. So if, for whatever reason, the economy is in such a configuration that the correct interest rate that you'd have to be pushing things down to is negative, well, then you hit that wall at zero, and that's why you're stuck. So at this point now, Krugman says that's why there's a role now for fiscal policy, because the Fed's out of conventional ammo, and that's why you need the government, the federal government, to come in and just spend a bunch of borrowed money. So that's the way you raise spending, because you can't do it through lowered interest rates. We need the government to step in and be the party that boosts spending so that total spending gets back up to where it needs to be. However, there's another subtlety. Krugman says, actually, strictly speaking, you don't need fiscal policy at all. You don't need government budget deficits. The Fed could do it, but it would have to engage in unconventional monetary policy. So there the idea is, rather than just buying short-term bonds, which once you hit the 0% lower boundary, doesn't do anything. All right, so just think about that. So Krugman thinks that a lot of QE1 and QE2 was basically useless. So it's not so much that he thinks Bernanke isn't doing enough, it's that he thinks Bernanke's doing the wrong thing. That Bernanke could have just changed the way he was intervening to get better results. Because Krugman and other Keynesians think once you get short-term interest rates down to 0%, if you just keep doing more of the same, which is buying, you know, short-term bonds, he said, you're not doing anything. You're pushing on a string, which is what, you know, a famous phrase that the Keynesians used in the 30s. Because when the Fed, let's say Bernanke does QE3, if he just does more of the same and buys short-term government treasuries or mortgage-backed securities that are of a short duration, he's saying all you're really doing is swapping assets that are basically equivalent. So if you're a bank right now and you're sitting on $1 billion worth of 1 month treasuries that are yielding basically 0%, and then Bernanke comes up to you and says, hey, I'll buy those treasury bonds off of you and I'll give you cash instead, Krugman's point is you haven't really changed much from the bank's point of view. They've given you bonds that are extremely liquid and that are earning basically 0% yield, and you now they're getting cash, which is more liquid and earning a 0% yield. So the difference between having $1 billion of actual cash versus $1 billion of very short-term 0% yield government bonds, U.S. government bonds, that's not much difference. So those two things, those two assets are basically interchangeable. And so Krugman thinks, you know, having QE3, QE4, if that's all you're doing, don't be surprised if nothing happens, because you're missing the point. He said what the Fed needs to do, if it wants to help, is change expectations. That Bernanke needs to say, we are going to cause 5% price inflation next year. And then if Bernanke could convince the public that he was serious, I mean, he was going to do that, then that would work, because people now, fearing that their cash is going to lose 5% of its purchasing power, would be more likely to spend in the present to get rid of their cash now while it still has purchasing power. Or another way to think about it is, even though nominal interest rates are stuck at 0%, if you expect future price inflation, then the real rate of interest is negative. So if you think prices are going to rise 5%, then the real rate of interest is negative 5% if the nominal rate is 0. So that's the way you can, in real terms, achieve your negative interest rate target, is by promising future price inflation. So that's what Krugman would say that Bernanke needs to do. It's not that he needs to just keep doing more QEs. He needs to conduct his operations in such a way as to get people to think that inflation is going to be a bigger deal down the road. So it's actually ironic. It's not that Krugman wants $400 oil, but he wants people to be worried about $120 oil, and then that would help. Just like if people were worried about space aliens invading, that would help in Krugman's mind, right? So, because his point is, he needs to put a word in his mouth. He needs to trick people, or let's use a less judgmental term. Krugman thinks we need to motivate people to spend more, and anything we can come up with that does that can help the economy. So if it's because we falsely believe that aliens are about to invade, and so we're willing to let governments borrow money and have the Fed print money to buy, you know, more cruise missiles or whatever, laser beams to repel the aliens, that's a good thing. That spending is what we need. Or if it's because the Fed scares everybody and says, hey, we're going to debase the dollar next year, so you better spend now, well, that's a good thing. So that's his worldview. Okay, Anthony says, in quiz 3, question 8, the answer was that every factor does not earn its DMVP because that might sum to more than the total output is worth. So this is for non-isolable factors, correct? In the book, Rofford keeps stating that factors earn their DMVP. So is he assuming that most factors are usually isolable? And then Anthony says, correction, I meant quiz 4. Right, this is... I apologize to this guy. I think Rofford's a little bit unclear in that part of the book, because Peter Klein and I were discussing this, and we have been dragging our feet getting back to somebody's been asking a lot of questions. I'm forgetting who it is now. The name. Hang on a second. I was literally just looking at this email. One second, guys. Let me just... Yeah, Jacob Champness asks numerous questions, and one of them centered on this very topic. So I was getting ready to go back into the forums, but I was running out of time and had to open up this session for you guys. You're right. So here's the way I think it works. Marginal value product, and then, of course, diminishing marginal value product, discounted marginal value product. You could always calculate that for any factor you want, whether it's isolable or not. Because by definition, all that means is what's the, you know, retail price or revenue you would get with the thing and then without it. You can always calculate those numbers. So the problem occurs when, what if, no entrepreneur is ever going to spend more than the DMVP for a unit of a factor. Right, that would be crazy. He'd just be throwing money away if he did that. Now, that doesn't mean, though, that every entrepreneur will spend the DMVP for every factor. Even if the thing is isolable, the entrepreneur wants to make as much profit as possible. So even if, you know, there's not an issue of this adding up problem, just a standard old thing where there's variable proportions and all that stuff, you know, no wacky cases, if the guy knows, oh, if I spend $10 hiring one more unit of this factor, if I hire one more unit of this factor, my revenue will go up by $10, he would like to only spend $2 on it and pocket the $8 difference. It's not like he wants to spend $10 on it. The $10 is an upper bound. He's saying, I would not spend more than $10, but he would like to spend less than it. Right? So every entrepreneur in general wants to get factors as cheaply as possible, and the DMVP just sets an upper bound saying that's the most they would spend, because if they spend more than that, they would be losing money compared to not hiring the thing at all. All right. But now you say, okay, normally you would think the forces of competition would mean, though, that in the long run and equilibrium, certainly in the ERE, not only would entrepreneurs pay no more than the DMVP for each factor, but you would think they would pay no less than the DMVP, because if something brings $8 to the bottom line, and one guy's paying $6 for it, why doesn't somebody else come along and offer $7, and then offer $7.50? But so the only logical resting point would be when every factor is getting paid at the DMVP. So that's what Rothbard has in mind when he says that stuff throughout the book about in the ERE, every factor gets paid at the DMVP, and that in the real world, there's a tendency for factors to get paid that. So there, though, I think you're right. I think he is contradicting himself, because he does have a small section where he deals with this problem where you can imagine cases where the definition we're using of how to calculate DMVP yields, or you can have a situation where if you add up the DMVP of all the factors that go into making a product, that number is bigger than the total value of the product. And so then it looks like, you know, the rule can't be true. So that's why you got to be careful and say the general principle is that the entrepreneur pays at most the DMVP. And so then when it comes to those weird cases where adding up the DMVPs would give a number that's bigger than the value of the product, the principle is still true there. And then you just supplement it and say the entrepreneur also, you know, the separate condition would not pay more for the combination of the factors than the total revenue. So that's consistent with the original principle that for any individual factor, he's going to pay at most the DMVP. So I think what's going on here, and I have to talk a little bit more with Peter Klein about this. So this, don't take this as gospel, but I think what's going on is economists differ with each other over how to handle that kind of weird situation. So some economists, they want to say that always and everywhere in a competitive equilibrium, a factor of production gets paid its marginal revenue product, or its discounted marginal revenue product, which means what DMVP means for Rothbard. Because if you guys remember, there was this question as to why does Rothbard use the term value product when really shouldn't that be revenue product? And all right, so mainstream economists, if you go to a standard class, I think they're going to call it marginal revenue product. So I think that they want to cling to that principle. And so when it comes to these weird cases of a bunch of factors that all have to be used, but it's hard to isolate what's contributing what. Like they all have to be used, or it's an all or nothing thing. I think a lot of the mainstream books want to say, okay, we'll use these other techniques, like if some of the factors can be used in other processes where they are variable and you can isolate them, you get the market price from those ones, and then you use that same market price in this process over here where that input happens to be, you know, used in fixed proportions and you can't isolate it. I think they want to say, and that even in the weird cases, then that is the marginal revenue product, whatever it was over in the other case. But I'm not sure that that's actually right or consistent with the way Rothbard's defining the MVP. So let me put it to you this way. The way Rothbard is defining it, I believe it makes sense to say, you know, a unit of a widget, this 10th unit of the widget could have a DMVP in this process here of $10 and a DMVP over here of $100. I don't think that's a contradiction to say the DMVP could be different in two processes, even if in equilibrium that there are units of that thing being used in both processes, just because of the way that the DMVP is defined. And then what would happen, though, is, of course, it's only earning $10 in both lines. Right? So it can't be that it's earning $100 over here and earning $10 over here, because then the sellers of it would just allocate it to where it was earning $100. So obviously, the owners of these widgets in competitive equilibrium are getting paid the same money price wherever they're selling to. That's got to be true. But what I'm saying is the way Rothbard defined DMVP, I think, and again, I could be wrong, but I'm going to go over this with Peter Klein, I think it would make sense to say even in the evenly rotating economy, widgets, you know, on the margin, widgets have a DMVP in this line where they're being used of $10, and over here, a DMVP of $100. They're not earning $100 over here because it's a weird process where you need a widget and you need this and you need that. And if you have all those things together, you can sell the product for $100. If you take away any one of them, the product is useless and you can sell it for zero. So the way we calculate DMVP, each of those inputs has a DMVP of $100. But the final good itself is only worth $100. So clearly that's not what they're going to earn. So that's a long way of answering. Yeah, I think you're right, Anthony, that's what the quiz question was asking. And when you're right, it was a little bit tricky because at times Rothbard does say in the ERE every product or every factor earns its DMVP, and I don't think he's right when he says that, or that's not consistent with the way he defined DMVP elsewhere in the book. So, but like I say, I think where that's coming from is, and why he, assuming I'm right and he did contradict himself, I think where that's coming from is that he's defining DMVP. Well, it's not that he's defining it differently, it's just he's handling those situations in a different fashion. That I think Rothbard wants to say, no, we defined it a certain way and let's not change the definition, where other economists, I think they want to say, normally when we define marginal revenue product, we mean what's the change in revenue if you add one more unit to the factor, but we use a different definition, or that definition doesn't work if you've got these weird cases where you take away one unit of the factor and the thing goes to zero. So it's not that they have a rival definition. They just kind of say, only use this definition in the standard cases. Otherwise, you got to use some different approach. So for them, they can say that in competitive equilibrium, every factor always earns its marginal revenue product. And the way they handle the sticky cases is they use a different definition for defining marginal revenue product in those weird cases, whereas Rothbard went the other way, or at least in one part of the book he goes the other way, and he says, no, DMVP is defined the way it is, darn it, and in those weird cases, you know, I'm going to the barricade. No, DMVP is what it is, and if that means in a certain case the DMVP of all the factors adds up to more than the actual revenue from the product, okay. Nobody ever said that a factor gets paid its full DMVP necessarily. But then elsewhere he did say that. So that's what's going on. But like I say, I'm going to run all that by Peter Klein, because Peter Klein also suspects that Rothbard contradicted himself, and he was kind of asking me, do you agree? And so I'm going to tell him what I just told you guys and see if he agrees with everything I just said. Okay, we got time for one more question, it looks like. So Benjamin says, the problem I see is that once the market determines that the debt, I guess meaning government debt, is so high that it can't be repaid, it will assume monetization will have to occur or default. Yes, that's true, but and so I think if you're going back to your question about Krugman and how can Krugman be saying this stuff with a straight face, so don't misunderstand me. I'm agreeing with you, and I'm thinking I think Krugman's crazy. I'm just since I think you're asking me like, how does Krugman reconcile all this stuff? I'm telling you what the way he does it. So Krugman is going to say that yes. In the long term, over the next 30, 40 years, there is a fiscal problem in the United States right now. That if we don't change the trajectory that we're on, there will be a default or there will be a need to do massive printing of money to pay these bills, in which case the dollar will collapse. So Krugman admits that. And he says, so the way you deal with that, or rather, the problem is tax cuts for the rich. Right, that right now we have relative either to the rest of the world or to even US history, we have relatively low marginal tax rates on upper income earners. So let's go ahead and raise those back up and get a lot more revenue coming in over the next few decades. And he says the big driver of these massive long-term deficits is healthcare expenditures. That it's actually even not really Social Security, it's more Medicare and Medicaid that's is what's going to blow up the US government's budget. And so he says the way you fix that is you do stuff like Obamacare and you do, you know, sensible things to contain healthcare expenditures that conservatives go nuts over and call death panels. Right? He says what's not the problem is having a few $1 trillion deficits over the next few years. He says the US right now, its debt to GDP ratio is lower than a lot of other countries. Like, for example, Japan right now, its debt to GDP ratio is, I don't know the exact numbers off the top of my head, but I think more than twice as high as the US. And it's not like the Japanese government has trouble borrowing money if it wants to. It's not like the yields on Japan's debt are 200 or like, you know, 20% or something. That investors happily lend money to the Japanese government, even though they have a huge debt to GDP ratio compared to the US. So Krugman thinks this, you know, the people worried about budget deficits right now and who want to have fiscal austerity right now are crazy. They're worried about stuff that doesn't really matter in the long run. Whether we run a $1 trillion deficit this year or a $2 trillion deficit, that's nothing. He said, what is something is containing healthcare costs over the next 30 years and extracting more tax revenue from upper income earners. So Krugman thinks, you know, in Krugman's ideal world, we would run much bigger deficits for the next 3 years. We would raise taxes on the rich, and we would put in place measures to control healthcare costs, which for Krugman means the government rationing of healthcare. And then that's the way you would fix the long-term budget problem. And if we did that, yeah, our debt would go up over the next few years, but then it would level off, and we would not get anywhere near a danger zone in terms of investors worrying that we were going to default. And Krugman, again, his ace in the hole is to say, if investors were worried about default on U.S. debt, why are interest rates so low? He said investors are worried about Greece defaulting, and that's why Greek bonds, you know, I don't know what the number is off the top of my head, but they're in the double digits at least. They might even be over 20%. So he says that's what it looks like when investors think that a country is going to default, is their interest rates go way up. He says, look at U.S. yields right now. They're at historic lows, so don't tell me that we better get our spending under control in the next year or two or the end is near. That's crazy. So again, I think a lot of that is why are yields so low? Because the Fed's buying up the bonds. And I also think that we're the analogy I used the other day on the radio that said, yeah, we're in this odd equilibrium, but the way I'm picturing it, we're a marble at the top of a mountain that's very narrow. And if any one of these things gets disturbed a little bit, whoosh, it's going to collapse really quickly. Whereas Krugman thinks that we're a marble at the bottom of a steep valley, and that we're stuck with this liquidity trap. It's hard, it's sluggish, and we can't dig our way out of this thing. And there's no danger of it all suddenly collapsing because he thinks all the forces are conspiring to keep us in the slump. And again, he thinks you cannot get rising prices, you can't get a falling dollar, as long as you have large-scale unemployment. So that's what he thinks. All right, guys, we'll have to stop there. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next week.